Noah Feldman is currently the Bemis Professor of International Law at Harvard Law School and is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Professor Feldman specializes in constitutional studies with a particular emphasis on the relationship between law and religion, constitutional design, and the history of legal theory. Professor Feldman received his A.B. degree, summa cum laude, in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations from Harvard University in 1992. He was then selected as a Rhodes Scholar and earned his D.Phil in Islamic Thought from Oxford University in 1994. He received his J.D. from the Yale Law School in 1997, serving as the book reviews editor of the Yale Law Journal. His latest book, The Fall and Rise of the Islamic State in 2008, tells the story behind the increasingly popular call for the establishment of the Sharia, that's the traditional Islamic law, in the modern Muslim world. He is also the author of Divided by God, America's Church-State Problem and What We Should Do About It in 2005, which is a careful examination of the history of church-state separation. Professor Feldman is also the author of a large number of articles. Of special interest to this audience, I would think, would be his article, What Is It About Mormonism?, that appeared in the New York Times Magazine during the Romney campaign. A devout Jew, Professor Feldman is fully versed in Mormon politics and has poignant insights into the Mormon faith and politics and how they intersect in the current environment, and how politicians, Mormon politicians, have been regarded and treated through the years, both how they've been embraced and sometimes ostracized. Professor Feldman is happily married to Jeannie Suk, who is also a professor of law at Harvard, and they are the parents of two children. We've been looking forward to this visit for some time and are now very pleased to welcome Professor Noah Feldman to Brigham Young University. Please join me in doing so.
Thank you so much, Vice President Tanner. Thank you, Mr. President. It's really an honor to be with you here today and to have an opportunity to speak with you in this forum. With your permission, I would like to begin by drawing your attention to one of the great states in our federal union. The state that I have in mind was founded by deeply committed religious believers, considered radicals in their day, who faced bloody and unremitting persecution in the place where they lived, who tried briefly exile and reformation of their community, but trouble found them, and they were forced once again to uproot themselves and their families and to travel thousands of miles under very, very difficult conditions, in shaky conveyances, to found for themselves what they hoped and believed would be for them a new Zion. They went to the far western reaches of the world that they knew, and there they did, in fact, succeed in founding an extraordinary new kind of republic for themselves. They formed an innovative government which merged religion with the state in complicated and rich ways and sought to give true meaning to their aspiration to fulfill a divine command, to create a collective community that felt very deeply that it existed to serve a higher purpose. In so doing, they faced real challenges. There was the challenge of dealing with the first peoples whom they encountered, sometimes peacefully and sometimes, alas, less peacefully. They also struggled with the grave difficulty of making sense of what it meant to be a community that was at once a religious community and a polity. And that is not an easy thing at all. It's a deeply difficult thing. And sometimes they had to deal with religious dissenters, some of whom were tolerated because sometimes this community had learned the deep and important lessons of having been persecuted, but some of whom sometimes were expelled because the community saw itself in a very fundamental way as serving a collective and a greater good. They also had to deal with the challenge of citizens who did not belong to the religion but did belong to the polity. Having succeeded in forming their new home, the community turned to education and founded a small religious academy that grew into a college, and from a college grew into a global and cosmopolitan university, with students from all over the world, with faculty from all over the world, and with a wide series of subjects of inquiry. And without their efforts, neither you nor I would be here today. And I speak, of course, of my home state, Massachusetts, and my home institution, Harvard University. Now, I imagine that many of you knew that that's what I was talking about the minute I began to speak, about the errand into the wilderness of the New England Puritans, their extraordinary effort to found a kingdom of God on earth. But if for a moment or two in the course of my description, you might have thought of a different place, of a different group of people, then I've already accomplished what I came here to do today, because it's only 11:15 in the morning, and already you're engaged in the study of comparative religion. Now, I'm glad that you may have, by your laughs, I think perhaps you did, and I'm glad that you may have thought in those terms for another reason, and that is that in order to dive into my remarks today, I would like to stick with the state of Massachusetts for just a few more moments, because I would like to speak about the history of presidential candidates from Massachusetts and the challenges that they have faced with regard to religion in the course of American history. And I'm going to start with the first one, John Adams, who was elected president in 1796. He was a Congregationalist, that is to say, a direct descendant of the New England Puritans who had founded Massachusetts. His own personal religious beliefs, I would say they trended towards Unitarianism without completely getting there. And his Calvinist roots were deeply felt in his own presidency. By contrast, in his presidency, President Washington and later President Madison, both of whom were Virginians, declared days of Thanksgiving. This is seasonally appropriate, since our Thanksgiving Day is the direct descendant of these public presidential declarations that the American people should give thanks to God for all the glorious wonders that he had done for the American people. John Adams did not declare a day of Thanksgiving because he was a New England Calvinist by origin. He declared a day of fasting, self-searching, self-reproach, for the American people to ask about why we were so sinful and why it was that God had brought all of these terrible punishments upon us. As you can imagine, he was not reelected. Though I think not solely for reasons connected to that. It is true, however, the election of 1800, John Adams' failed attempt for re-elect into the presidency, became the first election in American history in which religion was a major national issue. And interestingly, it was not Adams's religion that was at issue, but the religion of his opponent, Thomas Jefferson. In the New England states, which remained heavily Congregationalist at the time, it was repeatedly said that Jefferson was an atheist. And although Jefferson himself never quite acknowledged being an atheist, he never quite denied it either. And his rewriting, his personal rewriting of the Gospels, in which he excised everything that he was confident was not actually correctly ascribed to Jesus Christ, was, let me say, a very slim volume. In this, he anticipated some contemporary biblical criticism, in fact, where often it seems that the best method for guessing what it was that Jesus may or may not have said is to figure out what I would have thought or said and to see if it agrees. Jefferson, however, was open about this being his fundamental undertaking. This was a serious fight in which Jefferson was badly bloodied and in which from pulpits across New England, it was regularly said that Jefferson was unworthy to be president of the United States because of his lack of religious belief. And I think, in fact, it's possible in tracing the religious thought of this very great American, of Thomas Jefferson, to see a change in his views before and after this election. Before the election, He believed in religious liberty, in large part for the traditional reason, which was that religion ought to be protected from the government. The earliest motivation for the separation of church and state in Protestant thought, of which Jefferson was an inheritor, was not to save the government from the bad influences of religion, but to preserve religion, godly religion, from the worldly influences of government, and to protect religious people against persecution. In the second half of his career, after suffering at the hands of New England clergy, Jefferson turned, and he began to say that the reason for the separation of church and state was, at least as much and perhaps more, to protect government from the baleful influence of religion. So there were real consequences to this fight. Now, to go back to our first one-term Adams president, John Adams, his son, also John Quincy Adams, became president of the United States, and he, too, managed just a single term. And again, his religious tradition was Congregationalists tending towards Unitarian. In his diary, one day, this was after he had been president, he heard the great philosophical and religious thinker Ralph Waldo Emerson give a lecture at the Harvard Divinity School, which focused upon Emerson's great idea of transcendentalism. And in a very laconic fashion, John Q. Adams wrote in his diary, which he had kept every day since he was a small boy, I'm paraphrasing here, but it's close, "The speaker evinced a great desire to found his own religious sect." He was skeptical of the idea that one could go too far from traditional religion. Now, John Q. Adams became president of the United States in 1824, and it was another century before another Massachusetts man became president, and that was Calvin Coolidge in 1924. And in fact, I mention Coolidge only parenthetically because he was also a New England Congregationalist. It shows you just how little things had changed in the intervening century. And then, fast forwarding to 1960, came the run for the presidency of the next Massachusetts president, John F. Kennedy. And as you know, when John Kennedy ran for president, things, in fact, were quite different because Kennedy was running as a Catholic and faced tremendous criticism and struggle, both during the Democratic primaries and then in the general electoral campaign, over the question of his Catholicism, with the essence of the attack on Kennedy coming in the form of the suggestion that because he was a Catholic, he would inevitably be constrained by church discipline to listen to the church authorities, to the church hierarchy, and to do what they instructed him to do, either directly or more likely through their general religious teachings, when it came to making important decisions about government. Now, this became such a serious challenge for Kennedy that he and his political advisors decided that they needed, fundamentally, to take it on directly. And so in September of 1960, just a little under a month before the general election, sorry, just a little under 2 months before the general election, so with time for the issue to resonate through the media, he went to Houston, Texas, to give a talk to a group of Protestant ministers at which he spoke directly about the religion question. And it's a fascinating speech. The text can easily be found on the internet, and I actually discovered in researching this talk that, in fact, a video can be found on the internet of this. So if you're interested in this, don't take my word for it. Just go and have a quick glance at it. It's a remarkable piece of political theater, and you can see it firsthand. Kennedy's punchline was that the church would not control his policy judgments, and I'll read it to you. I won't try the accent. "I am not," said John Fitzgerald Kennedy, "the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who happens also to be a Catholic. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me." He went on to say that in any case of conflict between his own personal views and those views of the church, which he said was so unlikely to occur that he wasn't even willing to acknowledge that it would occur. But should it happen, he said, "whatever issue may come before me as president," and now listen to the issues that he chose, "on birth control, divorce, censorship, gambling, or any other subject," and I'll return to those subjects in a moment, "I will make my decision," said Kennedy, "in accordance with these views, in accordance with what my conscience tells me to be the national interest, and without regard to outside religious pressures or dictates, and no power or threat of punishment could cause me to decide otherwise. Now notice the topics that Kennedy took on. He took on what were the most divisive public issues of the day that directly in the public mind implicated Catholic teaching: birth control, divorce, censorship, that is to say censorship of speech, which the Catholic Church had been strong on, that is in favor of censorship, gambling. Now these are not precisely the issues of today. Today we would have to add abortion, we might have to talk about stem cell research, we'd certainly have to talk about gay marriage. But he, and this is the point, as a politician, directly confronted the most controversial issues. He didn't specify what his own views on those topics were. That was for other speeches. But he said that his views on those speeches would be his own, and they would be, as he said, in accordance with what my conscience tells me to be the national interest. Now, as we know, Kennedy's gambit worked, at least insofar as he got elected. But the first point I want to make about Kennedy's speech is that it did not succeed without some cost to formal Catholic religious teaching, then or now. And I think the key to this can be discovered in the fact that Kennedy very self-consciously used language of conscience that in the American public mind, perhaps unconsciously but very deeply, was associated not with Catholicism but with Protestantism. Now, let me say a word about why the idea of conscience is closely associated with the history of Protestantism rather than that of Catholicism. It has to do with one of the foundational moments in Protestant history, the moment at which Martin Luther, one of the first and most significant Protestant thinkers, faced down church and civil authorities, and when told, "Retract your conscience, Martin," that is, retract the views in criticism of the church that you have expressed as a matter of conscience, said famously, "I cannot retract my conscience because it would not be safe or right to do so. I am," he said, "only able to make judgments on the basis of what Scripture, reason, and conscience teach me." And in this moment, Martin Luther captured the difference between his own view and the view of the Catholic Church as it existed at that time in the 16th century. The view of the Catholic Church was that the individual did indeed have conscience, but that that conscience could be in error, and that when a believer was faced by a church authority who said very clearly, "Your conscience, sir, is wrong," it was the religious obligation of the believer to change his views and to retract them. Luther said that he could not and would not do that. He placed, in effect, his conscience above the responsibility of church authority to teach the truth. And this was a revolutionary thing for him to do, and it remained at the heart of the deep battle between Catholicism and Protestantism, which battle, as you know, was not merely religious or symbolic, but often involved actual human beings fighting each other, killing each other, putting each other on trial in both directions, for more than 100 years, and the echoes of which remained when John Kennedy was running for president in the United States in 1960. So although these events, Martin Luther's confrontation, occurred nearly 500 years ago, it's recent history, it's within the last 50 years, that such issues remained a meaningful topic of politics in our country. I'd like you to note, and this is the second point I want to make about Kennedy, I'd like you to note that today it seems almost unimaginable that there would be a deep divide between Catholics and Protestants in this country on the question of a presidential election. I'll come to this in a moment when I mention John Kerry. But notice that just 50 years ago, many Protestants were unprepared to vote for a Catholic for president, and the speech I'm discussing was a turning point, a crucial moment at which a 500-year process of confrontation began to dissolve itself, at least here in the United States, in American public life with regard to politics. Now, Kennedy, in effect, spoke the language of conscience because he wanted to reassure voters that he would act on his own accord, to refute their concern that because he was a Catholic, he would be president as a Catholic. And in the course of doing so, he in effect adopted what was, perhaps with a small p rather than a large p, but nevertheless, a Protestant vision of what it was to be an American politician, an American leader, according to which private conscience was more important than public religious teaching. So there was some cost, I want to suggest, associated with this comment that he made, but as we know, it was in practical terms a successful one. And last point about Kennedy's speech that I want to emphasize, Kennedy was following a tradition associated with Thomas Jefferson, whom I mentioned a few moments ago, who famously said that the opinions of a man on the question, a question of politics, had nothing to do with religion. He said, whether I would vote for someone or not, based on their religious views, has as little to do with the decision of how I would vote as that man's position about geometry. It's a good thing he didn't say biology or some other controversial topic. I guess he chose geometry on the grounds that he thought of it as wholly divorced from ordinary political realities. So that's the Jefferson idea, that religious belief have nothing to do with politics. And as you can imagine, in the election of 1800, he said that again and again and again. And it's important as a matter of the historical record to recognize that many people disagreed with him about this. But notice that Kennedy was picking up on that idea. And he was saying, don't vote for me because I'm a Catholic. Don't vote against me because I'm a Catholic. Consider the fact that I am a Catholic irrelevant to your decision to vote for me. I will return to this in a few moments. Before I get to John Kerry, though, the next Massachusetts Catholic to run for president, I want to just mention Michael Dukakis, a governor of Massachusetts who was the presidential nominee of the Democratic Party, as you know, in 1988, and Senator Paul Tsongas, another Massachusetts senator, former senator, who was a candidate for the Democratic candidacy in 1992 in the primary elections. He ran against Bill Clinton, ultimately unsuccessfully, though he did win in New Hampshire. Now, what's interesting about Governor Dukakis and the late Senator Tsongas when it comes to religion is that they were both Greek Orthodox. It's a remarkable, purely from a statistical standpoint, the idea that Massachusetts' two best presidential candidates in, you know, a long time were both Greek Americans who came from Greek Orthodox families and professed a continued connection to the Greek Orthodox Church is simply a remarkable statistical fact. I mean, there is a big Greek Orthodox community in Massachusetts, but not compared to the size of the state. But what's also interesting is that the content of the beliefs of the Eastern Orthodox churches, or of Greek Orthodoxy in particular, as far as I can tell, never in any moment came into political discussion, not at any moment in the campaign. And though I'm old enough to remember each of these campaigns fairly clearly, I thought that wasn't good enough, and I went and did some research in preparation for my talk. And sure enough, I found just one article in one newspaper from 1988 in the primaries of a junior staffer for a Republican senator objecting to Michael Dukakis saying that he was a member in good standing of the Greek Orthodox Church on the grounds that Mike Dukakis' wife was not Greek Orthodox, and therefore he was not technically in communion with the Greek Orthodox Church. And then that was it. This had no legs. This issue apparently had no legs. Now, that's as it should be, I think, in some important sense. But I think it's interesting because of the specific beliefs of the Greek Orthodox Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches with respect to the great mysteries of religion. It is a fact that the Eastern Orthodox traditions are mystery religions, deeply connected in their Christian tradition to even more ancient trends in Greek mystical religion, ancient Greek mystical tradition. And according to the vision of theosis that the Eastern Orthodox traditions subscribe to, the human goal is conjunction between the human and the divine, to become one with God. And the mysteries through which this occurs are mysteries of faith that other religious denominations call sacraments or endowments, which take place by necessity and by tradition in secret. So the consecration of the host, for example, in Greek Orthodox or other Eastern Orthodox traditions, cannot happen out in public before the public, but must happen secretly. And the priest turns his back and actually goes behind a screen. And many components of the Eastern Orthodox religious tradition are similarly focused upon secrecy because they are indeed religious mysteries. Now, I think this is something beautiful and something to be respected. I mention it only because had opposing politicians wanted to criticize or go after or try to undercut Mike Dukakis or Paul Tsongas on the basis of religion, it's arguable that they might have been able to find some ground there. But notice that they did not, something to which I will also return shortly. From 1992, I take you forward to 2004, when John Kerry was the next Massachusetts candidate for president, the Democratic candidate, a Catholic like John Kennedy before him. John Forbes Kerry was also JFK, a fact he likes to remind people of. Senator Kerry, who's a friend of mine, faced a different problem than John Kennedy had faced. Instead of trying to convince Protestants that, as a Catholic, they should vote for him, he had to convince Catholics that they should vote for him because of his views on abortion. And he did fairly badly at that. Several bishops made public statements to the effect that they would not give him communion, although a vote of the National Council of Bishops, Catholic bishops, came out, I think it was 183-6, against the view that he should be denied communion, by the way. But those six got a lot of headlines. And ultimately, John Kerry lost the Catholic vote. Just to make things more complicated for John Kerry, in the middle of this campaign, in which he was dealing with his Catholicism, it came out that both of his paternal grandparents were Jews, a fact that he himself had not known, and that his grandfather was a Jew from Central Europe who had been born Fritz Cohn and had changed his name to Frederick Kerry. Sort of a double whammy. First the Catholic Church is mad at you, and then in the middle of the election it turns out you're also Jewish. It's really depressing. And then there was Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, whose campaign for the Republican candidacy in 2000 and 2008 you all followed closely, as did I. Interpreting the reasons for votes is a difficult business, and I'm going to leave it to others. I will simply comment on two things. First, Governor Romney had very bad luck in running into Governor Mike Huckabee. It's very unusual for there to be a serious player for the presidency who's an ordained Southern Baptist minister, who has served not once but twice as the pastor to a church. This is very rare in American history. It's not unheard of, but it's very rare. And Governor Huckabee was not only a religious pastor, but also a good politician, which is to say he was a mean politician. All good politicians have to be mean. And he was prepared to say things which he could then apologize for, which he did apologize for, which enabled the relevant target audience of evangelical voters to be reminded of Governor Romney's LDS faith, and to frame it in such a way that the damage would be done. So Governor Romney decided to give a speech of his own, and I'd like to draw your attention just briefly to that speech. I imagine many of you watched it yourselves. It was a difficult speech for Governor Romney to give, because unlike Senator Kennedy when he ran for president, Governor Romney couldn't say that religion was irrelevant, because he believed, does believe, that religion is actually a very important component of public life, that one has an obligation to engage with religion to make sense of one's own beliefs and values, and indeed he was trying to appeal to values voters who felt the same way. To make matters more complicated for Governor Romney, he was prepared to say something about his religious faith, and he said, and I quote, he believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and the Savior of mankind, but he said he would go no further. Here's Governor Romney. There are some who would have a presidential candidate describe and explain his church's distinctive doctrines. To do so would enable the very religious test the founders prohibited in the Constitution. So he was saying, in essence, religion is not irrelevant to me, and I will tell you a little bit about my religion, but I do not wish you to ask me anything further about my religion, and indeed, if you do, you are violating the Constitution. That is a very tricky position to maintain. And I would submit to you that it was not successful, ultimately, in terms of the public sphere. Now, the question I want to turn to now in the last few moments that I have with you, the next 10 minutes or so, is the question of what alternatives there are, either for Governor Romney himself or, perhaps more importantly, for other politicians in the future who find themselves in a similar position of believing, not with John Kennedy, not with Thomas Jefferson, that religion does matter in the public sphere, that we should be free to ask about our own religious convictions when we make our voting decisions, and that therefore others should be free to think about religion too when they vote for us, but who simultaneously recognize that long-continuing bias against them and against their religious tradition remains a factor in enabling them to reach positions of leadership for which they are eminently qualified. That's the quandary I'm interested in. And I want to suggest to you that comparative religion, of the kind we've already been doing today, may have something to say about that. Now, comparative religion has a wonderfully attractive and appealing side, which I'm going to say a word about in a moment, but it also has a frightening and dangerous side, and I'm going to say something about that too. I'm going to start with the appealing side, because otherwise you'll turn and run, and although I know some of you have to go to class pretty soon, I'll feel bad if you get up and go to class 30 minutes before your class begins. So the attractive side of comparative religion is that it enables people of all different religious backgrounds to see the common bonds that unite us as human beings connected to faith traditions. And it enables us to do that by seeing that there are tendencies, streams, and trends within all religious traditions that can simultaneously offer some of the richest form of religious experience, and that are also in some ways disquieting, troubling, and difficult to deal with for aspects of the religious faith. And I'm just going to give you one concrete example, and that's the example of religious mysticism. No great world's religious tradition is free of, or is without, is a better way to put it, is without a mystical strand. So in Eastern Orthodoxy, which I mentioned a few moments ago, that strand is actually quite central to the religious worldview. It's a mystical strand that thinks of the conjunction of the individual with the divine. And without it, there almost is no central piece of the Eastern Orthodox religious tradition. Catholicism has a rich and ancient mystical tradition with which it has had always an ambivalent relationship. Sometimes in the Middle Ages, mystics would be seen as going too far, and the church would go and call them heretics and cut them down. At other times, mystics would be at the very heart of the church, and the mystical union of the believer, St. Teresa of Avila would be a great example, with the divine, becomes central to the church's vision, and the mystic can actually be canonized. Judaism has a long and complex relationship with its own mystical tradition, the Kabbalistic tradition, which has always risen up and then disappeared for long periods in Jewish history. And the rationalist strand in Judaism, which believes that you should be able to find the true teachings of the faith in the Bible and in the statements of the rabbis, the public open statements, has never been satisfied with the idea that there is a tradition, and the word Kabbalah actually means a tradition, of hand past manuscripts, of teacher-to-student transmissions, that, according to those who are deeply committed to it, itself goes back to the earliest roots of the religion, which are secret, which cannot be found in the general books, which cannot be understood by the general person, but which involve the individual in a mystical relationship, in a conjunction with the divine. Islam, too, has a rich and complex history of Sufism and mysticism. And even today, if one looks at the one Muslim world, one will see conflict between Sufis, religious mystics, and more mainstream, textually oriented Salafis. And of course, as I don't need to tell you, Mormonism too has a complex relationship with what I would describe as quasi-mystical ideas and teachings, especially those that can be found in the later teachings of Joseph Smith in his years in Nauvoo. And the complexity of dealing with those teachings and beliefs has itself formed and continues to form a challenge for LDS believers and authorities, just as it has in other religious traditions in the world. Now, if one can contextualize and explain that all religions have beliefs that are difficult and challenging for believers, that the relationship, for example, between the individual human being and God is itself the most difficult, mystically charged, complex relationship that it is possible to imagine, and that all the world's great traditions struggle with it, then one has gone a long way, I think, towards seeing the benefits and advantages of comparative religion. But there's also a danger. And the danger is this. In order to do comparative religion, one engages not in what you do when you go to the theater, where you suspend disbelief, but in something exactly reversed. When you do comparative religion, for a moment, you suspend belief. You act as though, in that moment, your religious tradition was just like every other religious tradition, and you bracket or ignore your belief, which you hold the rest of the time, that the difference between your tradition and the other ones is that yours is the true and the correct one. Now, this is true of all religions. And by the way, it's an important point of comparative religion to tell people that all religions believe that they are correct. It's not offensive to say, I believe that I'm right and you're wrong, because all religions believe some version of that, though all religions, at least in contemporary America, are a little uncomfortable about saying so overtly when there are other religious believers in the room. And so this moment of the suspension of belief has always, historically, been deeply threatening to religious organizers who are concerned about maintaining the belief of their community. If I can suspend, after all, my belief for the moment of comparison, perhaps when I go back to being an ordinary religious believer, a tiny spark of that disbelief will stay with me. And it might infect the whole, or to use a better metaphor for a spark, it might ignite the whole and throw me into full-on doubt. And doubt, though it's a state in which my religious tradition one spends a lot of time in, is nevertheless a very threatening state to a religious believer. So comparative religion has risks as well as benefits. But what I want to suggest to you is that when we wish to think about entering into the public sphere and speaking about our religious beliefs, we all, and I don't just mean here those of us running for office, but we all have an obligation on behalf of ourselves and of our broader communities to speak and think in terms of comparison. That doesn't have to be academic comparison. It can be full-throated, engaged discussion in which we're prepared to have conversations where we do, for the moment, suspend belief, and where we do focus on those unifying strands and themes across religions that unite us. Now, it made things very difficult for Governor Romney that he was being asked to do this himself as the presidential candidate. He should not have had to do that, and a good political consultant will tell you that the moment he had to do that, he was in real trouble. What he needs, and fortunately for him, he has, is a broad and diverse community of other believers, of scholars, of lay people, of people involved in religious practice, people for whom this university is an important hub of influence and of learning, to speak openly, to speak freely, to speak regularly, to speak unabashedly, and to speak in an engaged way with others in the public sphere about religion, about comparative religion, and about the ideas thereof, and to do so, first of all, without fear, second of all, without presumption, and third, with the understanding that it is only through, I believe, this sort of public debate and discussion that the process, the complex process of recognizing that all people, regardless of their religious faith, ought to be able to participate fully in our American public life can come to pass. Now, I don't think this will happen overnight. I don't think accomplishing it will be easy. But I do know one thing, and that is that it must start soon, and that in all probability, it must start here. Thank you very much.